Hello, welcome to another Pharmacy in Practice podcast. Mega excited this morning. Great way to start a Monday morning. Introducing Emma Davies. Emma, would you like to say hello?
Hi, John. Hi, everyone.
Hi. Is this I phoned you a few times on a Monday now. Is this your PhD time?
Yeah, this is one of my PhD days,
Okay.
supposedly. So yeah, it's a nice relaxed day.
Okay, so if we mention the PhD enough times, could I get a mention as an author?
If you mention it enough times, maybe I'll actually finish it. Who knows?
Well, to be fair, doing podcasts isn't helping, is it?
I'll blame you then if I overrun my time, shall I?
Oh, absolutely. Everybody blames me. That's fine. I'm Teflon. Right. Would you like to give a wee bit? I mean, you're a well-known, you're a saw this on Twitter. You're a BNIP.
What?
According to Thorin, you're a BNIP, a big name in pharmacy.
Oh, really? Oh, gosh.
Apparently so. So, would you like to introduce yourself?
So, yes, I'm Emma Davis. My job title is Advanced Pharmacist Practitioner in Pain Management, and I work in Wales doing that. I'm also currently studying for a PhD looking at trends in opioid prescribing in Wales, and I do bits and pieces of work with various national organisations, CCGs, and so on around, primarily at the moment, opioid prescribing.
Okay, so much to talk about, Emma. We need to find the positives here. That is our mission today, but we got to go to the negatives first. We got to sort of retrieve some positivity. So, question one: are you a leader?
I guess you'd have to ask other people that, wouldn't you, really? I think I'm always slightly suspicious of anyone who names themselves as a leader, because I'm not one of these people that believe leadership comes with rank. I think people can show leadership qualities regardless of their sort of deemed position in an organisation or, in society, whatever. I think leadership is more about doing. And less about having followers, actually, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally,
I think if you're too busy trying to get followers, you're probably not leading. So I'm aware that I might have been referred to in that vein, probably in the very narrow echo chamber of Twitter. But I think. Yeah, I think you'd have to ask other people. I'd like to think that I have had some positive influence on certain aspects of pharmacy, particularly in Wales, around pain management. But I would say that most of that has been done in conjunction with other fine colleagues, coming from different areas of working as well. I don't think I've really achieved a huge amount in isolation.
I absolutely think you fit that bill. I think my sort of I should declare that I have no official leadership training of any kind, so I'm completely unconsciously incompetent in leadership. So you got to take anything I say with an absolute pinch of salt. However, my view of leadership, in inverted commas, is and it comes and goes. It's quite ethereal. So some people will be leading one day and that leadership will diminish, and I agree it's absolutely not linked to rank at all, but it's like a leader is someone you gravitate to around an idea or concept, I think, or direction, and that's when folks start to follow. So I think what you bring is, if I may say, is just honesty, integrity, and a high degree of intelligence to any kind of conversation, and as a result, I think you people really look up to you actually, and I think your work in pain already is starting to break through, and I excuse the pun, And I hope you're recognised, if not now, in the future, on the national level, to be honest.
Oh, well, I feel quite embarrassed now you've said that, John.
Well, it's a compliment, take it, you know, well, I mean, well, run.
I'm not, my husband often tells me I'm not very good at taking a compliment, so, you know, I tend to sort of bat it off, but that's really kind of you to say. How true that is, I don't know. Again, you know, it's difficult to know, isn't it? Because I think sometimes we're operating in such narrow confines. So I know over the last couple of years, I sort of feel like perhaps my profile has grown through social media, and whether it's always warranted or whether it's just because I'm somebody saying something that other people aren't saying, or saying things in a slightly different way.
Yeah.
You can get a bit carried away, can't you? I think sort of thinking. I think that was Thorin's point, and you know, I speak to Thorin quite frequently, and I mean, she's somebody who I absolutely see as a leader, somebody who's, you know, making a noise in all the right ways and conducting herself in a really professional manner, I think, and drawing attention to real life problems that are faced out in community, and more power to her. But I think her point about big name in pharmacy, who is a big name and who thinks they're a big name, I suppose, are slightly different. And I probably will just shy away from thinking I'm one of them.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I agree about Thorin. She's a breath of fresh air, isn't she? And she, we need to get, you know, arguably we need to sort of get around behind her and support her, because I keep forgetting she's only like a year or two into her career. It's unbelievable, really, how
it's
mature she is.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
I know. I said that to her about a year ago. I think she was about a year qualified at the time, and I hadn't realised how I think she'd said something on a post, I think, about how it was a year since she'd graduated. And I thought, goodness me, when I was a year graduated, I was, you know, still getting signed off as having sort of accredited checking skills or something in hospital pharmacy and being absolutely useless. And there she is standing for the UPB and, you know, and showing that she's more than capable of holding her own with people who have been around a lot longer. And sometimes you think because of that their opinion counts, but I think people like Thorin, and you know, in their early years, we need to be listening to their voices a lot more. They're the future, aren't they? They're the future of our profession, and I think we ignore them at our peril.
Absolutely. And when they, you know, get into a position like Thorin has, I'm very reluctant to go down this route and speak about, in the spirit of collective responsibility. I'm still a board member for the RPS, so I don't want to go down that route. But ask me again in July. But I think Thorin needs support on the English Pharmacy Board. I think her ideas are refreshing, common sense. Yeah. She sees the value in community pharmacy. Good luck to her. You know, get on with it. Support her.
Yeah.
I don't know, she should be chair or vice chair. I'd love to see her as vice chair.
It'd be nice to think that even if it wasn't Thorin, and I mean, you know, she's so fiercely intelligent, she could do it standing on her head, I suspect. But just, I think we need to see in all organisations, so, you know, not pointing at anyone in particular, but just in organisations in general, I think you ignore the future wrongly. You know, if you don't take people's ideas on board, if you don't at least give them space to be heard, then you risk making mistakes and people give up and leave if you feel that your voice isn't heard. And just because you haven't worked somewhere for 20 years doesn't mean that your opinion of how things could be changed is less valid, and I think that that's something that all large organisations need to learn from. You see it in the NHS as well, that more senior people take management roles. I mean, they're renamed leadership roles, aren't they? But kind of back to your first question, and they, I think, mistake time in post as having the answers to all the questions. And I've never been a believer that that's true. I'm not a believer that small groups of people should be making decisions for large groups of people. I think you need to find a way to incorporate everybody's opinion, or at least give them air.
Yeah, totally.
It's often lost, and I think to the detriment of the organisation.
Well, I think, I mean, I can say this because I've said it many times in public business at the Scottish Pharmacy Board that, I mean, my opinions on fixed terms are well known. And I'm not, I wouldn't say I'm standing down because of that, but cue the long pause. I feel like I want to stand down to get some perspective and so on. I think the way that organization's governed, you're right, it's similar across other large organizations. There is a balance and an optimum. It's not a binary thing. You've got to consider corporate memory, and some of the people that have been on the board for years have given an absolutely incredible contribution. But there is a balance between that and allowing people like Thorin to come through, and actually protecting the organization from people like Thorin. So, and I don't say that in a negative way. I say that in a positive way, because, someone like me, and there's no doubt when I got elected, my social media thing, following helped probably. So
yeah,
we need to protect against that, actually. So in a way, I'm kind of, by suggesting fixed terms, I'm kind of saving the organization from myself in a way.
I think you have to appreciate that people get elected for all sorts of reasons, don't they? So,
yeah.
If you're senior pharmacist in an NHS organization, and you can gather your department around and get them to vote for you, you're more likely to get in. I mean, we have the problem in Wales that we don't get a huge number of people standing for the Welsh Pharmacy Board. And so people, and I think it's happened in Scotland on occasion as well, where people have got in because they were the only ones who put themselves forward. Now, that's not necessarily a negative thing, because if you're putting yourself forward, you clearly feel that you have something to offer. And I think, everyone, if you feel that, then you should be given the opportunity. But if it turns out that you've got in just through, bluster and social media profile and no substance, I suppose at least with a fixed term, there is an end in sight for an organisation who feels perhaps they've got somebody who's not entirely altruistic in their motive for being involved in the first place. So there's pros and cons for both. You do need experience, don't you? You need people who understand how organisations work and how you get things done. And I think that's something that Thorin and other members of the EPB have said. Because, I mean, let's face it, we tend to hear more from the EPB than the other home nations. Is that within a large organisation, you've also got to appreciate that decisions are taken as a group. And so one single person going in, breath of fresh air or not, are going to be quite limited, I suppose, in terms of the influence they can have. And so as members, we then also have to be aware of that and not put too much onus on that person making significant change or being understanding when the things that they have perhaps said that they would like to achieve are not achieved, because it's not as straightforward as just, people going in saying, well, this is my wish list and I expect all of this to happen, because it's an organisation, isn't it? And it's already set priorities before you've even got involved, and you have to work with it. So I think having fixed terms is good, whether there needs to be some discussion about how many fixed terms, but I do think the idea of somebody sort of remaining in any organisation in a particular job for 20 plus years, just start to perhaps grate after a time, particularly if you don't see much change happening.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a multifaceted issue, and you know, that's the view I've taken anyway, and it's in public, but I probably don't want to say too much more about it, and you know, out of respect for my fellow board members, and that is around, there is something there, right? That's a big thing I've learned around collective responsibility, you know, have your say in the board meeting, and then you know, you got to follow the line then. So anyway, let's move on. Quite a tricky topic this, and I go back to the to my bullying series that I did last year. So have you got a view on bullying?
Oh, I love it. Yeah. I have very strong views on bullying, as somebody who has been bullied for a significant time. And, you know, I was reading something just the other day about how most people who are bullied have probably bullied themselves. And I was thinking, it is difficult, isn't it? Because when you read about the definitions around bullying, a lot of it is to do with the perception of the person. So how a person perceives another's behavior towards them. It's about how it makes them feel. And so, of course, I'm sure that there will be people out there who have come across me at some point in my life and who would say that I have bullied them. I would like to think that wasn't the case, but I know that I will have said things myself that have probably hurt somebody's feelings or have made them feel pressured and in some way, and that they might well have felt that. And I think that's one of the things that makes this such a difficult topic, and that I think that people and organizations struggle to address because of that very sort of subjective nature of it. But I think that there, at the same time, there are some very clear cut cases, and certainly in my situation, there's been some very clear documented behaviours that have been very, well, far too easily dismissed, I think, by the people on the basis that, oh, well, we didn't read it like that. And the whole concept around bullying being in part how the person perceives it has been totally lost, and I think that's an easy thing for organisations to ignore, is that section of it. So I have very strong views about it. I have very strong views about lack of corporate responsibility for dealing with it, and I have very strong views about endemic levels of bullying in large organisations and how that's addressed. I think I've already rambled well away from your question there, haven't I?
No, I love your ramblings, Emma, as ever. It's great. my view on it, well, my view based on my, yes, fair enough, on my own experience, but also on after speaking to possibly 15, 20 people last year, some of which I published their story, I reckon there's bullying behaviours. And then again, it's not a binary thing. So there's bullying behaviors, but then there's bullying in inverted commas. Mm-hmm. And I think we've all probably, myself included, have been guilty of, you know, exhibiting bullying behaviors. I think back to when I first became a pharmacy manager, and I just wanted to just take over the world. I thought my pharmacy was just going to, you know, lift off into outer space, mm-hmm. and I was going to get every item possible in the, you know, a 5 mile radius. Yeah. Now, in my enthusiasm, there is little doubt, and I say it with some shame, there's little doubt that I probably put too much pressure on some of my colleagues at that time, and that could have been seen as bullying behaviours. Mm. In my defence, I guess, I probably lacked insight because I was so inexperienced as a manager. Now, I think when you cross, or the Rubicon that is then crossed, is when you, when it becomes premeditated, or when the bullying behaviors go so far that there's no return for the bully, and they have to keep bullying to possibly protect their own position, or so on and so forth. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I think, as I said, I think we're probably all of us at some point guilty of bullying behaviors. I mean, if you ask my kids, they would definitely agree with that. But I think absolutely. I think when that some people get into a position where perhaps they feel that certain behaviors have been an advantage to them, and they become quite ingrained. And one of the interesting things when you read about bullying and around definition, and if you read, say, organization policies around bullying, they often refer to this sort of like the unconscious bullying behaviors. And that so the first step in raising a concern is to draw somebody's attention to those behaviors and to tell them this is how you are being perceived by this individual or this group of people. And the idea behind that being that perhaps these are behaviors that have been taught or habitualized, and perhaps the person doesn't have the insight. If you've ever had that conversation, if that conversation is ever had with you, and then you fail to change your behavior, then that's when it becomes more deeply ingrained on an
Yeah,
individual
agreed.
basis. I think what worries me increasingly, and from talking to colleagues in all sectors around the UK, is how ingrained it is in organizations, and how easy it is for organizations to turn a blind eye to it. And by nature, they are then complicit in the bullying. And I think that's certainly something that I've experienced. And the problem with that is that people who are exhibiting bullying behaviors, if you are not either, if it's either not drawn to your attention, or there isn't particular sanction for those behaviors, and there is this sort of complicit ignorance within an organization, it continues. And certainly in something like the NHS, where senior staff might be responsible for junior staff and their development, then junior staff see certain behaviors and think, oh, well, that's okay. And it just perpetuates, doesn't it? It just continues indefinitely. And I think sometimes the reason for that is because actually doing something decisive, which could involve sacking somebody, is just too hard. I think NHS HR departments rightly take an awful lot of flak because when you read about bullying cases in the NHS, what you see is repeated failures by HR departments to follow their own procedures. And then they get caught in this trap where then they're scared to do anything decisive in case they haven't followed the correct procedure. And then, there are certainly cases where people have been found guilty of bullying, but then have ended up getting some massive payout from an organization because the way the case was handled was, didn't fit with procedures or wasn't, based in law. And so then the organization has then stymied itself entirely in doing anything in the future. And that's the kind of thing that needs to be addressed, I think, as well. So it's not just individual behaviors. I think it's organizational behavior as well, which needs a good hard look at itself, really.
And there's people I've spoken to over the months and years recently that, have told me about these non-disclosure agreements. I know they're mentioned in celebrity circles, but perhaps the more sinister, in my view, use of them is to basically hu possibly hush stuff like this up, isn't it? You know, yeah, we'll give you a payout. Yes, this happened. Privately, we acknowledge it, but actually in public, you can't talk about it. And that's, to me, that's sinister, because then things will never improve, you know, the collective sort of view on the thing will never develop. I totally agree with what you just said. How do we, well, first of all, well, you've kind of answered that question about where is it worse, but how do we fix it then?
Well, I think the first thing we need to do, you know, is talk about it a lot more. I think people need to be empowered to talk about their experiences without fear of there being retribution. You know, you have to be really careful, don't you? Because you have to be able to actually have some proof of what you're saying has some basis in fact. But I think where that is the case, we do need to be able to talk about it. But I think we also need to have some real decisive action from a large organization that actually says there are consequences to this. And it's interesting talking to people working in private businesses, so sort of outside of healthcare. So my sister, for example, worked for a quite large organization, and there was a case of bullying, and it was all dealt with within about a month, I think she said. So, you know, people were sort of becoming aware that there was a situation going on. The person who was being bullied reported it, presented evidence. The person who was the perpetrator of the behaviours was brought in. There was an investigation. It was determined that they were, you know, at fault and didn't show much remorse, and were sort of, you know, got rid of out of the organisation. And that was all within about a month. My case has been ongoing now for nearly 8 years. With absolutely no resolution. and that's sort of seen as quite acceptable in the environment I work in. And it's absolutely not. So we need to sort of learn about how we actually deal with these cases, which are always difficult and always have multiple sides, more than two sides very often. But until we actually, you know, until organisations are prepared to actually sit down with people and have very open and transparent conversations about behaviours and perceptions of behaviours, it's never going to change. And they have to be prepared to make bold decisions, which has to include sacking people.
Yeah. But often, I was just going to say, often it will be, I guess the frustrating thing for me is in all of this is that it's just a management thing. You know, you take my example. I would be surprised if what I, you know, if my behaviors when I was just qualified as a manager in a role that was probably too difficult for me, I wasn't ready for it. You know, that's a management thing. That's, you know, I need to either, I at that time I needed to either be moved to a different role or coached or managed, whichever.
Yeah.
All of the above. So,
I think that's very often at the heart of it, isn't it? Is that people feel out of their depth or they feel threatened. So certainly in my case, and you know, unfortunately or not, or maybe it's, you know, personality defect on my part. But I, you know, I was bullied in school. I was bullied when I worked for a large pharmaceutical company. Or pharmacy company, I should say. I was bullied by a previous, you know, manager, and then the next situation was being bullied by a different professional, so from a different professional group. But the key thing that I've always had fed back to me is that I am apparently quite intimidating, which I always think is hilarious because I'm like 5'2". And you know, I'm just not a very big person, so I obviously have a very large personality. But I've been told, you know, that I sort of how I the fact that I'm sort of quite professionally assertive, I suppose, because I'm in a social context, I'm not a very confident person at all. But in a professional context, if I'm working within my area of expertise or you know, specialism. I'm confident. I was taught that from an early stage in my career. I had fantastic mentors from very early on in pharmacy who taught me to be confident and who gave me confidence because of the way I was supported and the way I was taught and the knowledge that I possessed. But when you rub up against somebody who perhaps isn't as confident as perhaps they appear in their own ability or their position, or, you know, like you said, in your position, you just probably just felt a bit out of your depth. And mm-hmm. what you needed really was the, you know, an arm around your shoulder and let's go for a cuppa and have a chat about this and see how we can help you. But very often people don't get that, do we? You know, we're all so busy, no one's got the time. Well, you applied for that job, so if you weren't capable of doing it, you shouldn't have applied. You know, all of these sorts of things happen and reinforce the situation. And then people then feel that they have to behave in a certain way to defend their position. So, you know, if you're leading a service, for example, and somebody sort of says, oh, well, you know, have you considered doing something in this way instead? You can see that almost immediately as a challenge to that person's authority. And so how they choose to respond to that, they might feel is reflective of how they are leading or their ability to be the leader of the service or whatever. And I think this is where organizations fail so badly is in, you know, when issues around bullying or threatening behavior or whatever are raised, that they tend to circle the wagons, perhaps. They start worrying more about how this reflects upon them as an organization rather than resolving the issue between the two people or the group of people that have raised the problem in the first place. And perhaps all it would take at that stage is a cup of tea, you know, a sit down and let's just all thrash this out and see what, you know, we must have more common ground than not. But that doesn't happen. That support, you know, the arm around the shoulder just doesn't seem to be there. And I think it could save an awful lot of heartache for all parties. So, you know, in my situation, I'm damaged by the situation that I've been trapped in. But I understand that the other people involved will almost certainly feel exactly the same way because, you know, I feel that I'm not being listened to. Certainly none of the concerns that I've ever raised have actually been dealt with. But if I feel like that, I suspect probably the other group do as well. And then you just end up, you know, actually what you're battling is the organization, but how it ends up being is that the problem between the two groups worsens, but actually we're actually fighting the same thing at the end, which is the incompetent management who should have dealt with the situation very early on. But because you're never brought together, you can't even find that little bit of common ground, and it just sort of sours everything and makes everything so much harder to deal with.
And I guess the longer it goes on as well, you know, like go back to my example. I keep referring to my bullying behaviors, but
it's all about you, never, John, isn't it?
I know, it's always all about me. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you finally realized that. That's fantastic. but yeah, if my example was nipped in the bud, then it doesn't become a huge issue. But you're right, really interesting point you make. The huge irony around all of this is that people will, you know, the bullier and the bully, or sorry, the person bullying and the person being bullied, they probably have similar insecurities. And you're right. And without saying too much, through my experience on pharmacy and practice, you know, no one sees it, but loads of people get in contact behind the scenes, and you know, they've comments. Some are nice, some are not, and you just got to have integrity and pick your direction and try and do what I think's best for the profession. But I was contacted around some of the articles, and the impression I got was that the organisations are absolutely, I want to swear here, I'm not going to, they're absolutely petrified around any mention of bullying or any association of bullying in their organisation, which to me is complete denial, because I bet you 100 quid most organisations that have more than, I don't know, 10 people in them have at one point or another had cases of bullying. So to deny that is just daft. And I think, I don't know, what I don't know is how you detoxify the issue almost, to allow the wiggle room to make it okay to accept that bullying does happen in certain workplaces. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but I think that there's a degree of human nature in it, isn't it? Because there's a degree to which we all will climb over the bodies to get to the top if we think it's going to, you know, further ourselves in some way or protect ourselves in some way. And I think that we have to accept that even within healthcare organisations, not everybody is there for altruistic purposes. We're not all there because we feel, you know, we want to make a difference, or, you know, these things that you say at university interview, isn't it? I just want to help people. No, I'm sure that's why everybody enters it. But then, you know, there's always going to be competition. There's always promotions. You know, there's always restructuring. There's so much pressure within the workplace, in private and public sector organisations, that there's always going to be an element of competition. And where you have an element of competition of some sort, it is going to, in some people, bring out certain behaviours.
Mm.
So it's naive of any organisation to think that if they just pretend it isn't happening, that makes it true. And it's all very well doing things like you see in organisations, you know, publishing their values, for example. But if there is no outward sign that organisation is then working to those values, or if on an individual basis you don't feel that you're being treated in line with those values, you think, well, what's the point? You know, it's all just lip service, isn't it? At some point, as hard as it might be, there needs to be quite a public display of something happening. I mean, you know, at the moment, I don't want to turn this into a Brexit podcast. There's enough of them about, isn't there? But if you look at the behaviour of politicians in the UK at the moment, or, you know, you look over the Atlantic to America, the behaviour of Donald Trump and how much more accepting the public seems to be at the moment of what we would deem to be bullying behaviours, you know, publicly slamming people, publicly lying, publicly saying you didn't say something which is on record that you said, you know, all of these sorts of things, being very derogatory about other people has become acceptable, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when it's never been acceptable. And I think most, you know, decent-minded people would say, well, it isn't acceptable. But if you see it happening at such a high level and so publicly, in some people's minds, it is now acceptable to behave like that. And so even if it was drawn to their attention in a workplace, you know, you can't speak to people like this. Well, you could say, well, I've seen, you know, this politician did that, so why can't I do it? I think, you know, it's a societal problem, but also within organisations, they really need to think, well, how do we want to be perceived? And part of moving it on is to be much more open about the processes that are in place and to make space for people to bring those concerns forward without fear of retribution. All organisations have got an anti-bullying policy. They've all got things like dignity at work policies or grievance policies. And what's really disturbing when you start looking into the data behind workplace bullying is how frequently those policies are not adhered to by the very organisations that sign them off. What's interesting, you know, I've sort of gone to the Ombudsman in Wales about my case and was told, well, you know, we don't have the powers to investigate concerns raised by employees. So they put me in touch with another organisation whose name has completely escaped me now. I'll have to have a look for that whilst I'm talking to you. But it was quite shocking, actually, how few organisations there are that you can go to for help and advice around these sorts of issues as well. So even sort of from a professional perspective, I was quite in the dark about where to go for help and support.
Yeah, I think there's a, I think social media has an awful lot to answer for. You know, it's really difficult. Mm. It's really difficult not to have an opinion these days. So you know, there are things that I just am not that bothered about, you know, and in my private life, somebody asked me an opinion about that and I'm like, well, it's not that I don't care, but I just don't really have an opinion either way. Yeah. Is that okay? But on social media, you can't not have an opinion. Now that's one aspect to it. So that creates a very combative environment. That's why I like doing the podcast actually, because you can ebb and flow through a topic, can't you? Mm-hmm. You know, it's a lot more balanced, and there's the personal social element to it. So no one, you know, you're not so disinhibited when you're speaking to an actual person. And the final thing that I think in all of this, and it leads back to your Brexit point, is around, I just think of my mom. She's you know, Northern Irish lady, just doesn't take any nonsense. She has instilled values of integrity, you know, honesty, all the rest of it, good manners in myself and my brothers and the wider family to a certain extent. Now, whether I live up to those at all times, she would often contest those, even as a 35-year-old. However, I think, there is a final thing actually, but there's the local bit as well. So there's the lack of local accountability on social media and online around all this. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you know, Trumpism is really, he is the manifestation of this. So good example is, if, you know, when you're young, you turn 18, you go to the pub in the local village, you know, you have too many sherbets and you sleep on the park bench or something. You know, you and I have never done that, Emma, of course, but you know, if you were in your local village, your mom and dad would hear about it and they'd give you a rollick. Well, mine would give me a rollicking, you know. And those values have stayed with me into my adult life. The trouble is online and with this Brexit stuff and with Trumpism and all this sort of, I don't know what you call it, but not, that stuff just doesn't apply anymore. So it's a really deep social problem. It's a degradation of our social fabric. It's not a race thing. It's not a sex thing. It's nothing to do with anything like that. It's just, what are our values as individuals?
I think it's very easy to hide, isn't it? And I mean, I think you probably started seeing this when emails became the, you know, the acceptable way for communicating. And, you know, I've certainly seen it, you know, and I've probably done it myself, where I felt much braver to put something in an email than I perhaps had the courage to say in person. And I think one of the things that I've learned over the last few years is to, you know, to be prepared to do both. So don't ever put something in writing that you're not prepared to say to somebody's face. But a lot of people are very brave in an email or on a tweet or, you know, on posting something on social media. But then you sort of meet them in person and they can barely look you in the eye.
Yeah,
and
I know, just think, well,
and this is the problem, isn't it? That sort of behaviour has become acceptable, but that kind of behaviour can be very hurtful. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have the courage to say it to somebody's face, then, you know, There's, I think there's too much sort of putting stuff down just to try to get likes, isn't there? Just to build a persona. And of course, we know on social media, you put forward a persona that you want people to think you have, not necessarily what, you know, the person you are. I was quite strict with myself. I only went on Twitter a couple of years ago. I blame one of my friends for encouraging me to do that at Pharmacy Congress, but she regrets it too, actually. She said, I don't expect you to tweet as much as you do. But I thought, well, if I'm going to do it, my Twitter feed tends to be, I set out for it to be primarily around my professional side of my life, I suppose. Because of my sort of research side, we're encouraged from a sort of postgrad perspective to put stuff on that's relevant for our research as well and build our research profile, because that's absolutely necessary in academia. It's a very difficult world to break into. But I thought, if I'm going on, I have to be the person I am. I don't want to pretend I'm different to how, you know, if somebody met me, I would hope that I would be as I am on Twitter, as opposed to different, you know, that I'm not someone who's prepared to say things on Twitter, but, you know, wouldn't actually speak up at a meeting or something. But that's the decision I took. And I guess, you know, people make their own decisions about how they're going to use those medium, don't they?
But I think you're right.
But I think either way, you need to be held to account. You know, the behaviour is unacceptable. It doesn't matter whether you wouldn't say that to somebody's face. The fact is, nowadays, saying something on social media is seen in exactly the same way as saying something person to person. Mm-hmm. So we shouldn't excuse things on the basis that, oh, well, it's only on Twitter. Because actually on Twitter, millions of people potentially could see somebody say something really derogatory about another person. You know, the lines for defamation are increasingly blurred, aren't they? And I think that's what perhaps people need to realise, whether it's too late now to pull ourselves back from the edge on that, I don't know.
I'm not sure, but I do know it's something I've been thinking about a lot, you know, doing the magazine, doing Pharmacy and Practice. What's really unfortunate is that a very controversial headline with some kind of note of jeopardy in it, like, for example, you know, car crash, the one last week was car crashes through pharmacy window, will get loads of hits, you know. But one of the most sensible news stories I've reported recently was Rosemary Parr, when she said, more or less around Brexit, keep calm and carry on, you know. Now, I think 11 people looked at that, you know, and that is our problem. That is the problem with social media and all that.
I'll have to check how many people read Andrew Evans' piece on that, because Andrew Evans is our pharmaceutical officer here in Wales, and he did something similar. I'll have to find out if people listen to him as well.
Wonderful speaking to you, Emma. Really interesting. Thank you for sharing your thoughts around, especially around the bullying thing. I think there is hope and light at the end of the tunnel for many folk, but I do agree with you, it's an institutional problem, but we've got to just keep talking about it and in a very balanced way, not in a kind of snowflakey way. And I'm not saying for one moment you come across as the opposite of a snowflake. You're very logical and level-headed in your thoughts and have good insight, in my humble opinion. So that's not the case, but I think we just got to keep talking about it.
I can assure you it's taken time to get there.
I bet.
I've sort of said in the past, you know, I'm left with, I have a diagnosis of generalized anxiety disorder, which people who meet me in person might sort of, or who see me present or something, often the perception is, well, if you have anxiety, you couldn't possibly go and speak at a conference or something like that. But of course, it's a lot of it is contextual. But I think the important thing is, if you're feeling bullied, or if you're feeling that you're being threatened in some way, firstly, there is help out there. Public Consent at Work is the organisation that I was trying to think of just now. So that's an organisation that provides free legal advice and support to people who are whistleblowers, or, you know, who are struggling with having raised concerns in the workplace. As pharmacists, obviously, we're really lucky we've got pharmacist support, and I would urge people to use their services. if they are feeling, you know, in need for some additional support. And sometimes to go outside of your organization or your group of friends or your family is really important, just to get a really sort of objective view on things as well, and help you get things straight in your own head. And then I guess the rest of it then is how you choose to deal with it. And there's a guy called Richmond Stace, who he's a physiotherapist but does lots of work in, he's a pain management specialist. And I attended one of his workshops about 18 months ago. And he quotes a philosopher who, when asked, "How are you today?" says, "I'm choosing to be happy." And I think that's such an important lesson to us all, isn't it? That mm-hmm. actually how we choose to be is really important, because how we feel does not have to be a reflection of how other people are trying to make us feel. We can choose to feel different to that. And I think that the important thing that I have learned, and I can assure you it took me several years, I didn't get to this overnight, is that you can take a negative experience and turn it into something positive. So I've used a negative experience and tried and used it as a motivation. So even if it is essentially a metaphorical two fingers up to the people that are making you feel bad, I've turned the energy that I could have wasted making myself more anxious and more unwell, and tried to turn it into doing something productive. So, well, these people are saying I'm no good at my job, that I don't know anything about my subject area. Well, I'm going to prove you wrong by undertaking and getting involved with all these other bits of work in that very area. And there is a subversive two fingers up, but at the same time, it's about self-worth, isn't it? And acknowledging to yourself that actually these things that are being said about me are not true, and I can prove that to myself. Because if you don't believe it yourself, you won't make other people believe it. So absolutely. You have to find in yourself somewhere to regain your sense of self and self-worth. And it's hard. And so that's why, you know, the organizations that are there, you know, really draw on them, because, you know, there are people in those organizations who do understand and who will help you to work through that. And I think that's something positive that has come out of my situation is I feel like a stronger person at the end. It's a cliche, isn't it?
Well, it's not, it's not, no, stronger, no.
But I think there is actually some truth in that. But don't underestimate the amount of work it takes to get to that stronger position, because it is really hard. And I think that's unfortunately perhaps, I think that's why we need to talk about workplace bullying a lot more, because organizations need to realize that the effect of that doesn't, it, you know, you don't get in your car at the end of the day and drive off and it's all gone.
What I was going to say to Emma is that I think that's why people look up to you and admire you. And I know you're far too modest to admit it, but it's obvious that you're lifting yourself out of a situation and you're excelling at it. And that makes what you're achieving all the more impressive. And it's why I and many others do, whether you're going to deny it, I know, so don't speak, but you are a leader in pharmacy, and I believe that. And a lot of it's because you're not looking for it. I really believe you're not looking to be a leader, but you are. So I'm gonna finish it on that positive note. Okay. And I'm not gonna give you a right reply on that, because you'll just deny it. Thank you so
you know
much.
You for... quite well, don't you?
Well, I know you well enough. I know you well enough. But it's been a pleasure, and thank you so much for coming on. I've really enjoyed it. No, really interested.
Yeah, it's lovely to speak to you, John, as always.
You too. All right, we'll speak to you soon.
Okay. All right, take care.
Cheers, bye.